You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
And it's that time of the month again. We always have Hutchinson Legal in once a month, and I have with me Adriana and Grant. Welcome.
Thank you.
G'day.
Grant, we left you with a question last time that we're not out here to bash the Catholic Church in any way, but they have brought in that the priest should disclose if they're told of particularly of a sexual nature, and you were going to go away and say, first of all, what effect that was going to have, and then secondly, whether it covered lawyers and other people. So who's going to tell us?
Well, let me just put the framework. So if something's said in the confessional, the question was, given the law has changed so that priests now, when it actually comes into force, and it's not yet in force, it's been passed but not in force, would they be required, and what would be the consequences if they don't? And of course, well, I can tell you from the outset that with a great degree of hypocrisy, lawyers are still exempt. I'll deal with that, and then Adriana will deal with the priest situation. So the thought is that a lawyer is able to be told anything, and then it's caught by legal professional privilege. That is, the information given to the lawyer belongs to the client. So it's their information. Therefore, a lawyer cannot disclose that because it would be a breach of their professional obligation. So there is a degree of hypocrisy in that we still maintain our rights. But if you can't tell your lawyer, then your lawyer can't properly represent you. And so there needs to be that frank disclosure. But of course, lawyers cannot allow the court to be misled about certain things. But the court, they could always ask for the prosecution to be put to their proof. So they have to prove the charges before, but not have to...
And I think that's part of this Royal Commission over Gobbo, isn't it? About what she was told, and then what she did with the information.
Oh, no, don't start with Gobbo.
I don't want to start that.
Oh, well, sorry. So certainly, there are so many questions that are raised by Gobbo and what would happen in... and the police knowing that... clearly she was violating legal professional privileges. We shouldn't make any final determinations, but it certainly appears, based on the evidence given to date, that it would be hard for it not to think that she was supplying information that she obtained from one client and giving it to the police. But over to what happens with the priest.
Adriana, tell us about the priest, please.
So with priests at the moment, the law hasn't been passed, so they are still governed by something that they call canon law. And that's a law that the Catholic Church abides by, and being the supreme legislator is the Pope. So at the moment, their law states that the sacramental seal is inviolable. What is said in confession stays in confession. So the law coming into changing if child abuse is disclosed by anybody in confession, it would have an obligation on the priest. The first thing that I want to point out is Catholic priests already have mandatory disclosure obligations, and every Catholic priest goes through mandatory disclosure training. But that is outside confessional. So if something is said to them in the church or anywhere outside the confessional box, they have to disclose that already. So there's already that obligation there.
So this is just taking it into the confessional box.
Correct. There's been a number of questions about this law. Firstly, Bishop Greg O'Kelly, who's the administrator of the Adelaide Catholic Archdiocese, he has stated that he believes this law to be nothing more than symbolic, because in the Catholic Church, especially in this day and age, absolution, which is what you get at the end of confessional, if you've, repent all your sins, you receive absolution. That in modern Catholicism, that's actually done in Mass. So the Catholic goers are asked to repent their sins, and the priest will put out, an absolution for the entire church. So commonly now, most people go into confessional for their first confession around 7 years old, and commonly that's the first and last confession. So going into confession isn't actually as common in this day and age as what it used to be. So the bishop has taken the view that it's symbolic. If something is mentioned in confessional under these new disclosure laws and the priest decides not to disclose that, they can face up to jail time under the new laws. But also under their canon law, if they make disclosures in confessional, it's an automatic... what are they called?
Excommunication.
Yes, automatic excommunication.
So that means they get the sack, is that...?
Pretty much, yeah. So it puts priests in a tough position because they... For a priest, it's do I abide by the laws of my Catholic Church or do I abide by the laws of the land? And Bishop O'Kelly has taken the view that you will need to abide by the laws of the land. But with that said, realistically, how many people are going to make confessions to child sexual abuse now that they know that these laws are in place?
But then in Victoria, hasn't the high Catholic person here said, well, we'll go to jail?
Yes. So he has, but...
So isn't there a sense that if these things are confessed, and the excommunication is more than just they're out of the church, for a Catholic it would mean, wouldn't there be questions in terms of do they get to heaven? I'm not sure.
Yes.
So there'd be all sorts of issues for them in terms of with their beliefs about, in terms of being a part of the church is so important.
Indeed.
But wouldn't normally a priest... Okay, let's not lay it on too thick. But yes, eternal damnation. But wouldn't normally a priest say to somebody, repeat that to me outside, and then they can encourage them to...
And that would be
particularly
the best
if a child,
way to go, wouldn't it?
But if
there's
a child's,
no guarantee that anybody's going to do that, is there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So whether it's symbolic or whether it'll be surprising to find a charge happening quickly in relation to this.
Yeah.
So we'll see. But it's jail time plus excommunication. Oh, sorry, rather than excommunication.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, yes, that's...
Now, I think we'll move on because we're not here to bash the priest. The idea is, well, we just want to know two things, how it would work.
Yep.
And the other thing is, too, you've got down here that it... teachers have to, doctors have to, nurses, teachers twice, principals and police, and any youth worker. I know any youth
worker,
anybody in that sort of field. But it doesn't extend to the journalists. I'm surprised it's not in sport, journalists or lawyers. I can understand lawyers because you've got to try and defend them, but sports and journalists.
Yeah, journalists, like yourself, Alan, you have too many rights.
We don't want to make fun of it, but I think it's just something that part of what we want to do here with Community Connections is to try and educate ourselves and the public as well.
Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections, and I've got Grant and Adriana with me. Grant, we're going to talk about contempt of court, which probably, hopefully, a lot of people don't know about.
Yes, well, hopefully not from personal experience, at least. There are some things that just corrupt our criminal justice system, and so there have to be things in place to stop bribery, contempt of court, or making false statements to courts.
Yep.
And so if you're just running through that, so it's clearly if you are bribing a public official or you're bribing somebody if you get caught doing that, that's a 10-year jail sentence. Is where you could end up there.
That's longer than they get given for murder at the moment.
Well, of up to, yeah. Well, let's not get there. But it's very serious. Well, of course, you could lead to somebody being convicted or being, it disrupts the normal flow of justice of what should be. The other one is false statements, and then I'll come back to contempt of court. But when you're giving evidence or you swear an affidavit, you do a statutory declaration, or even if you're going to the police to report a crime and you make false statements, you can get in all sorts of trouble. So,
well, we've had a couple of those in the last little while, haven't we? Where didn't she say she'd been raped or something and they found out that it wasn't true?
It's not that it doesn't happen, but it's very, very rare. And yes, I'm sure that has happened, and it's very unfortunate, particularly if it's used in family law or other. These things can happen, but of course we act for victims of crime all the time, so We have a predisposition to advocate for the victims of crime. But if you make a false statement, then there's perjury. So that if having found that that was false, that could lead to going to court themselves. Making a false statement is a crime, or making a false report to police. But getting back to contempt of court, this is the one that... what happens if you're in court and the court feels that you're not taking the whole thing seriously? You're interrupting, or you're refusing to answer, or otherwise. There was a case where you're challenging the court's authority. There was a case recently at it was this year. It was a we won't name the we could if we wanted to, but it was before the Fair Work Ombudsman, and there was orders made that this person had to pay money that was owed or alleged to be owed or found to be owed to the employees. So $29,000, that's where it started off. $29,000, you've got to pay this. Yeah. Didn't pay it.
For wages or didn't matter?
For outstanding wages and entitlements of three of the employees. So that was a company order that was... when they didn't do that, then they were hauled back. And there was a pecuniary penalty, so a penalty of $55,000 to the company and $12,000 to the individual gentleman concerned, who was, I suspect, effectively in control.
So it's gone up nearly $80,000, isn't it?
Well, I think they were feeling they weren't being listened to, and so then there were also orders put in place freezing the company assets, saying you can't dispose of your company assets. So that you can't, effectively, these judgments are worth nothing. So effectively, you cannot use the assets of the company other than in the ordinary course of business. Anyway, it was felt by the judge that the freezing orders were breached. And so guess what they did?
Right.
12 months. The person was ordered to serve 12 months jail time for contempt of the...
But that's not... That's just jail time for the contempt, is it? That doesn't wipe out all the fines?
No, it doesn't wipe out the fines. Mm. But on appeal, it was found that the judge had erred and may have just got a little bit too, how to say it?
Heavy-handed?
Well, whether or not he was the person denied procedural fairness during the trial, whether the judge misdirected himself in relation to what's proper and what's in the ordinary and proper course of business. So what would be the exceptions? It was found that the judge may have interrupted the person or kept putting questions to this person, and in the end there were certain criticisms made and the person got off. But there's still the risk that if you show complete contempt and disregard for the court, that there are penalties, including, and normally a magistrate might say, take them down for, and it might just be a few hours. But this person appealed immediately, so didn't spend any time. Interesting on the point of contempt.
I suppose when you look at it, justice relies on people going to court and telling the truth, don't they?
Absolutely. So if somebody's ordered, but what happens if somebody says, "Well, I've got a medical certificate saying I'm not well enough to give evidence"?
I shudder. Keep going, Grant. I'm a bit worried.
Well, let's not name this lawyer, but let's just say it was a particular letter. And so, what would happen if that person was ordered, despite the medical certificate, to give evidence? Where could that go? Who knows?
Well, it could go to contempt of court, couldn't it?
Well, if... Look, I think it's really hard to get that charge up. So, if there was a medical certificate, but we'll see. Who knows? But what's the final recourse here for a tribunal? That somebody who says, I can't come and give evidence, or I'm not well enough, and they say, well, we don't think that's... we still think you're able to get here and answer questions.
Well, in the justice scheme, who would be the highest, the judge or a doctor?
If you ask any judge, it's a judge. That's easy. You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections, and I've got Grant and Adriana with me, and we're talking all things legal. You're going to talk about
drunkenness, and I know that wouldn't impact you.
Neither
myself, and hopefully neither you, Adriana. But so the state government has decided to decriminalise, so it's no longer an offence to be drunk in public alone.
Correct.
Now, can you tell us why that was a good idea? According to you, but according to the government.
So these new laws have been brought in just before the inquest into deaths in custody. The view that has been taken is that public drunkenness or drunkenness in general is a public health concern rather than a police matter, and as such should be treated as one. So being drunk in public has been decriminalised. So that means if you are walking down the street and you are intoxicated, that is no longer a criminal offence. However, if you are out in the street intoxicated and causing problems, that is still an offence. So drunk and disorderly is still a criminal offence, and you can still be taken into custody for that.
So when you're talking disorderly, what are you actually saying?
Well, each case is assessed on its own merits, of course, but disturbing the public peace is the term that's used.
Are we saying fighting, or you could just be a pest?
You could just be a pest. You could just be yelling and screaming in the streets, for example, swearing in the streets, that's drunk and disorderly, or, you know, straight out fighting with someone or causing a disturbance.
But just tottering down the street, leaning with a breeze, is no longer a crime.
No longer a crime. So if you are minding your own business, keeping to yourself, and you are intoxicated, not a crime. Yep. I believe if you are walking down the street intoxicated with an open bottle, and that's still against council laws, so St Kilda Foreshore, for example, at certain times you're not allowed to walk around with opened alcohol. That in itself will still be an offence.
And I think that's places like Lawn, Sorrento, Rosebud and all that over the Christmas period.
Yeah. So that will still be an offence, but being drunk in public on its own is not an offence.
So let's get this right. If you're, say, at a holiday place where they have got these restrictions, a person could drink in their tent and then wander off down the street, they're all right.
Yeah.
But if they start to cause trouble...
But it could be as simple as if they stop to relieve themselves in public. That's now still a criminal offence.
Well, it should be too.
Yes.
Fair enough.
So moving along.
What else would you? Well, underage drinking is also an issue. So what happens? When can you drink? Obviously, we know the age of 18. In America, it's considered 21. And the science seems to be coming back that the brain's not fully developed to a state that's safe for alcohol until even later than 21, if you want to play it safe. The later people start to drink, normally the less social problems that result from that. Some people would say it's better to, you know, introduce it to your children when they're young. Well, certainly a parent or a guardian can allow a child under 18 to drink. But what happens if there's an 18th birthday party and people who are contemporaries who are still 17 turn up? What goes on then? So,
because the parents of the child can't let them drink. Like the parents of that child who's having the 18th birthday can't take responsibility and let the other kids drink, can they?
Absolutely. So it's against the law to give alcohol to a person who's under 18 unless you have consent from the parent or the guardian of that particular child. So this is a case where... So the thought would be, to protect yourself, you'd want something in writing.
From every guest.
Go figure how you get that. I don't think the kids would tell what's going on. But obviously, I don't think police raid every party. But if a party bounces out onto the street and is causing trouble, then the next thing is, yes, they could be looking and seeing what's going on. But if it must be a crime if they're drunk then... Even if they're not causing a nuisance, if there's a raid, then they must have taken alcohol. So then the proof, somebody would have to prove that they had consent to supply alcohol. So, and it's pretty serious. If you supply a young person in a licensed premises with alcohol, that's anyone under 18, the penalty is 60 penalty units. Now, a penalty unit is $161 odd. But so that comes up to just shy of $10,000, $9,671.40. But what about the young person themselves that orders it? What's the penalty for... It's only 5 penalty units, so they get away with just over $800. Still, it's a lot difference. More. Well, I suppose one's a commercial enterprise selling, the other is the kid trying to get away with it. But either way, there's a criminal offence, and there's... So you shouldn't hang around outside bottle shops and have young kids. You can't go in and buy alcohol for them.
I was just going to ask that. What's the penalty if say, an 18, 19, 21-year-old goes in, buys the alcohol, then gives it the young child? Is there penalty points for that as well?
I believe that that goes to more like 10 penalty units. So, well, certainly the individual that serves alcohol to somebody under 18 can get 10 penalty units, which is only... $1,500, so about 16.
Still not good.
It's not a lot of... Well, that's not a lot of money.
Maybe not to you.
Sorry. Whether it fits the crime, it's not whether it's affordable. Don't worry, the $800 one was enough for me. So underage drinking, that's obviously something that, as a society, we don't want to see. People can go to pubs that are under 18, but they have to go with a responsible person, like a parent or grandparent or guardian, and hopefully they're there to eat a meal. So there are some exceptions.
You were saying before about 18 being the legal age. I mean, there has been talk for a while that you've got a real problem, haven't you, that you've got your 18-year-old very often gets their licence and also can drink at the same time. So... There's a bit of a maybe sure. That the alcohol should be a year later or something to let people settle down?
Yep, certainly. Well, there's a zero, you know, that's a zero amount. What
blood
is it?
Blood alcohol reading.
Yeah.
So for pee bladders.
Yes, so young people. Right. So what are you past? You're past your peas now, of course. So.
18 to 22.
The other thing is, too, that did you notice in the paper the other day, where some guy's just been in court because he was at a party, the old guy got a bit molly to bunk and asked his grandson, I think, or his nephew to drive him home, who was on L's. They put the L's on, and the law is that the licensed driver has to be sober.
Yep.
Well, no, yeah. So they should be.
I know that after I'd had an operation and I couldn't have grabbed the wheel, my arm was in a sling.
Yeah.
I know that I was still I wasn't drinking though, but I imagine I had, I think the doctor had given me something. I was, so maybe I should look at that. So are you...
I wouldn't be saying that on radio.
Oh, very minor, very minor.
Just before Grant winds up,
just before I get
we'll take a break.
You're listening to Lawyers Grapes and Gripes. Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections on Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley, where it's 13 minutes to 1, and I've got Grant and Adriana with me, and we're talking all things legal. Grant, you're going to talk about carrying weapons.
Yes, and I should say there's a bit of information we've been getting today from the fact sheets that Victoria Legal Aid put out. And so in relation to carrying weapons, you really can't carry, possess or use a weapon to hurt a person or defend yourself. So it's... you might ask yourself, when can you? It's obviously... So guns, you can't own or buy a gun until you're 18. You must register the gun and have a license for it. Now, that even includes, Ellen, if you've got a replica gun. We had a guy that clearly it was a gun that couldn't be used, like it hadn't even been the drum or the barrel. Right. It wasn't even, you'd have to saw through it. So it couldn't have been used in its state. But these things, you have to... Anyway, I suppose they could be adapted to be used. So,
and does the perception as well.
And what would, like, is a pocket knife declared as a weapon?
You cannot carry knives, kitchen knives, Swiss Army knives or box cutters, batons, cattle prods, naturally, or bayonets.
I haven't seen many walking down the street with one of those.
You haven't been out enough. But you can if you have a lawful excuse. So if you need it for work... for a sport or recreational items, but a lawful excuse, you cannot say I need it for self-defence. So you can't be carrying these things around for self-defence. So if you're found at a shopping centre with carrying around a machete, that's carrying a weapon, and you're in trouble. So,
well, we'd hope so too.
But even the Swiss Army knife, they're pretty small. Well, particularly some of them. So you can only possess or carry some weapons if you do so safely. So you can't carry weapons. Well, these your regular fare here: your flick knives, your daggers, your butterfly knives, your knuckle knives, your swords, your nunchuckers, your knuckle dusters, your Shanghais, your blow guns, your imitation firearms. You can't even take round capsicum spray or slingshots. These are all things that would be, or weighted or studded gloves. You can't, or anything that could throw catapults without a special exemption from the police. So carrying weapons is one of those serious things. Now, of course, if you're under 18, if you're aged between 12 and 17, you can get a license to use a gun from the police. If you're learning how to use the gun for sport, and you can get a license, or if you're learning how to use a gun or for sport, and you can only use it if your parent agrees in writing. So your parent or guardian would have to say in writing that they approve. You're a member of an approved sporting club. If you have done firearm safety training, and you are a responsible person. So there you go.
That's fair enough too.
Yeah.
Look, if I have a gun license, can I carry the gun on the street?
I don't.
I think you've got to carry it in the case, don't you?
Yeah, I think it's certainly on. I know when you go on an aeroplane, you have to book it in. It has to be in a special case and it's secured. The law says you can't carry, possess, or use a weapon to hurt people or defend yourself. So if you were hanging around a sports club, and that's what they're about, obviously. But the safe thing is to have them secured, both travelling to and from. I trust that's the answer you were looking for, Adrian.
Yes.
Naturally, any information you hear on this program is of a general nature only, and so it shouldn't be relied on in your individual circumstances, but rather you should seek individual legal advice. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back to Community Connections on Yarra Valley FM 99.1, the voice of the valley. We're at 6 minutes to one. Now, we've had some phone calls since you were here last time, and we'd like you to take them away and bring us back some answers next month if you can.
Yep.
First of all, someone was driving down the street. This person was driving down the street, and I think it was a green and red light. They went through the green and the other one came through on the red, but I'm not sure of that, to be honest. But it was at a corner, and he looks both ways, there's nothing there, and he continues on, and all's and it's not on his right where he did, if he failed to give way, and he gets cleaned up. The other car sort of bounces off. It's a big car, probably a four-wheel drive, and is able to drive away. So we've got a damaged car. They ring the police. The police say, well, if there's no one nobody injured, we can't really come to it. We've got other things to do. So
they both stopped. They both stopped at the scene.
Well, the other one bounced off and then just kept going.
Oh, well, you shouldn't. No, anyway, as I understand it, if you leave without giving details, that's something the police could get involved in.
Well,
we'll come back to you.
We'll come back on that. Anyway, he has his car towed away. It's about a $6,000 car. Takes it down to panel beaters. The panel beater has a look at it and assesses it all, and then rings up and says, well, you know, it's going to cost, we'll have to write it off. He then finds out that he needs to have, I should have said that somebody got the number plate of the car as it was taken off.
Yep.
So he then finds out that unless he can give the insurance company the name and the address of the driver of the car, then he has to pay the $2,000. So he goes to the police, and the police said, well, under privacy, we're not allowed to give it to you anyway. But they look up and they say, it's worse still, that car was stolen. Now, the guy's question is, he didn't have any extra money. He had a $6,000 car, which was quite usable. Now he's only got $4,000. And how's that fair? Is it just the insurance company applying on it? Isn't what he's saying, can't the law do something about that? Now, the same sort of scenario happened from another person who rang me. Theirs was a bit different. They parked it on the road and went to the shopping centre. Some shops. They heard a bit of a noise and they finished the shopping. They came out and there's people standing around a couple of cars, one of them being theirs. So they went up to the group and said, oh, this is my car, and it was quite damaged. And he said, and they said, well, don't worry, we've got the number plate of the car. Now, he's not entitled to that from the police because it's a privacy issue. Mm-hmm. Same thing, it rocks up the insurance company, and this guy has got a bit more money and was a bit more expensive car, but he is in the same boat. He's now got to pay $1,500 just because the person shot through. And he wants to know, is that legal, or is the insurance company playing games with him? So that's at number two. Number three, I had a phone call from a lady only this morning. Now, I suspect she's in this bit of a problem herself, and I think this could be a fascinating look at. She wants to know if a car's going to be repossessed. So you've got finance on the car. What process does the finance company have to go through? Can they just send her a letter and say, well, you haven't made the payment, so we're going to repossess your car? Do they have to go to court to get permission to repossess the car? How many letters have they got to send her? But number four, is it repossessed by the sheriff, or is it repossessed by somebody who goes around repossessing? And if so, what sort of authority have they got? If it's in her drive, can they just come in with a tow truck and cart it away? If it's parked on the street, because I would have thought that was trespass, but I'm not the legal person. If it's parked out in the street, can they do it? Or if it's parked at her work or something like that, can they just come and pick the car up? What legal rights do whoever's possessing that car or repossessing that car got to do?
They're great questions, and all car-related. You seem to be a bit of a motorhead.
Well, we seem to have had a few of the last ones of the cars, haven't we?
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. And we were going to talk about dogs next time, but it sounds like it's going to be cars.
Well, particularly, I mean, what I was saying to you just privately before, that not many of us, luckily, know anything about repossession. Yes. And this lady said, well, she wouldn't tell me, but I presume that's the situation she's in, and she wants to know what sort of things have got to happen before the car is repossessed, and then what sort of authority they've got. Obviously, if someone gives the authority to repossess it, but does that allow them to come in on your property and take it? Or
we might even deal with what happens when you park on private property and somebody says they're going to tow your car away. What rights do they have there?
Yeah.
So we'll, the good thing is Adriana and I probably won't be here next time.
All right, come on. Why is it too hard?
No. We'll pass this on to more junior people, won't we? Because these are too easy for us.
Look, unfortunately, our time has come to an end. I've enjoyed it again, Grant, as we always do.
Yeah.
And
thank you for your hospitality.
We will look forward to seeing you or someone from your office the second Wednesday of the month.
Whenever you tell us to be here.
We'll be here.
Take care.
Thanks very much. See ya.
Thank you.